Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. On our show, we get a previous guest to ask a question of our current guest. So take a listen.
If you could do one thing to change or address the educational system in this country, what would it be?
And here's how our upcoming guest answered.
I think the one thing that would have the biggest and longest term impact is to change the standing of what it means to be a public school teacher. Public school teachers ought to have triple the salary that they have today.
On One with Farai, we're speaking with Alec Ross, author and former diplomat for the U.S. State Department. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you have been credited with taking a key role in what we call digital diplomacy, which is something that, like so many things in our world, didn't even exist a decade ago. Let's start with that. What is digital diplomacy?
The idea behind digital diplomacy essentially is that diplomacy ought not just be conducted between elites. White guys with white shirts and red ties talking to other white guys with white shirts and red ties, flags flying in the background, mahogany table and cup of coffee in front of them. Rather, our diplomats ought to be engaging with publics, since it is increasingly the case that publics, more so than just elites, are driving geopolitical outcomes around the world. So digital diplomacy was really about taking the diplomat outside of the traditional setting of diplomacy and having him engage with the wider world using digital tools.
Tell us a little bit about the Twitter moment that happened, you know, regarding Iran. That was a seminal moment in the evolution of digital diplomacy.
It was really interesting. It was June of 2009, and the Ahmadinejad regime in Iran had ordered every reporter to their hotel rooms. Simultaneous to this, hundreds of thousands of people were protesting on the streets of Tehran, and there was literally no way of getting information out to the wider world except for the tweeting that was being done by everyday Iranians on this from the streets of Tehran. And so that was the way that information was getting to the wider world, and frankly, it was the way that governments were getting information about what was happening. So the Twitter moment, such as it was when a colleague of mine, Jared Cohen, reached out to Twitter to ensure that they kept their networks up in Iran when they otherwise were being scheduled to be taken down. So it's sort of the first moment in foreign policy where a revolution was being tweeted, much in the same way in which CNN sort of revolutionized news gathering and news making during the first Gulf War, when that was the first sort of 24/7 CNN war.
What role do you think social media has to play for good and ill in terms of giving people a chance to engage in debates? Because, for example, in many situations, people have asked, like, well, if you're on Twitter or another platform, don't you think you can be tracked down? And isn't there a security risk to activists who are standing up for democracy? I know that was a big thread of debate during the extended Arab Spring.
So I don't take a sort of techno-deterministic view of the way that events play out in the world. I think that while some people believe that you can sort of tweet your way to democracy, I don't necessarily think that that's true. I do think, however, that what social media is doing is it's changing the political ecology around the world. It's changing the nature of who can participate in political processes and how they participate. It's also taken us from a world of information scarcity to information abundance. So I'll point to what's happening in Ukraine right now. Everybody around the world is paying attention to it. But just 6 years ago, Russia did almost the exact same thing when they invaded Georgia. And a lot more people died in Georgia than have died to this point in Ukraine. So why is this A1 above the fold news today regarding Ukraine, and nobody paid attention or cared 6 years ago in Georgia? The reason is simple. Because of social media, a government like the Putin government can't control the information environment the way it did previously. When Russia invaded Georgia 6 years ago, it was able to completely control the kinds of images that went from outside Russia and Georgia to the wider world. Today, everybody is watching in real time what is happening in Ukraine in the same way in which they watched what was taking place in real time in Syria and in Egypt. Now, having said all of this, there are obviously very real security risks. We know, thanks in no small part to Edward Snowden, that governments, including the United States, but others, have remarkable capabilities to track people's communications and identify where they're communicating from. So if you're using an open platform and if you are not using crypto, then you're putting yourself at significant risk. A lot of the people who propelled the green movement, the green revolution in Iran in June of 2009, are rotting away in jails in Iran today because of that.
So give us another take on your life as a diplomat with the State Department. What did you think that you were hired to do when you went to the State Department, and what did you actually end up doing? You know, you and I had known each other from your life before diplomacy. How did you enter this world, and how did it unfold for you?
So the way that I entered this world was really through politics and my nonprofit. You know, my nonprofit had worked in the technology world, specifically using technology to help people leave poverty. I then ran technology and media policy for Barack Obama's presidential campaign in 2007 and 2008. And when Hillary Clinton recruited me to join her, it was really interesting the approach that she took to my hire. It was relatively undefined. And, you know, this was at a time where she was taking what she thought was going to be an entire federal government worth of people. She thought she was going to be president. And she had to squish them all into one department, into the State Department. And the one exception she made was for me, you know, somebody who was then referred to as the quote-unquote Obama guy. And the way she explained it to me, she said, you know, look, to the same extent to which the internet so disrupted the presidential campaign, and in her case for the worse, so too she believed that the internet and increasingly ubiquitous and powerful information networks would disrupt foreign policy for both good and ill. And so she said, you know, I need somebody at my elbow like you to help me understand this and to help build an agenda for us. And things really played out that way, you know, both for good and for bad. You know, for good, we built some spectacular programs that helped stop political assassinations in Syria, that helped take down narcotics cartel leaderships in Mexico. For ill, we saw how the internet worked against our interests on things like WikiLeaks. So it was a very, you know, she didn't know how all of this was going to play out. But in the 4 years where I worked at her elbow, it certainly proved true that 21st century networks really impacted the conduct of foreign policy.
How do you believe WikiLeaks affected the ability of the U.S. government to operate internationally? Can you contextualize how this has changed the game for the U.S. government?
Sure. So I think that the Snowden revelations have had far greater and more meaningful impact than the WikiLeaks revelations. You know, the WikiLeaks revelations caused a stir at the time, but I think the lasting impact has been very minimal. And it's in large part because what they were trying to do was whistleblowing. And what whistleblowing is it reveals an act of official wrongdoing. But in those 250-some-thousand odd cables that went out, what was reported was right-doing. You know, what it showed was that our diplomats said and did in private exactly what our public policies were. And so while it infuriated, you know, a handful of leaders around the world who were insulted in the cables, the lasting impact of it, I think, largely faded 2 or 3 years out. I think there's a little bit more paranoia as it relates to interacting with our diplomats, but I don't think that it's had an overwhelming long-term impact. I think that there's a certain segment of the political left, with which I self-identify to a degree, but there's a segment of the left that I think reacted quite angrily to the United States government's opposition to keeping the cables classified. And for them, I think it's had sort of a lasting negative impact, but I think that that's been much more among the sort of intelligentsia than among everyday people and then, frankly, government leaders around the world.
And why do you think the Snowden-Greenwald information had more impact than WikiLeaks?
Well, first of all, I think that the substance of what was conveyed was far more important. If you look at what was revealed in WikiLeaks, specifically related to the diplomatic cables. You know, there was some great gossip, and there was some intrigue, and there were some details that the general public generally don't have access to, but there was nothing of a scandalous nature. There was no indication that the U.S. government was lying or misdirecting the public in any way. It largely told people what they already knew. With the Snowden revelations, I think the reaction was one of overwhelming surprise and dismay because of the substance of what was revealed by Snowden. You know, even the president himself articulated the degree to which he was troubled by what was revealed and what was happening in his own government. The then Secretary of State, John Kerry, said that it looked like the NSA was working on autopilot. And people around the world, largely concentrated in Europe, Brazil, and the United States, but that's still much of the world, were dismayed by the degree to which the U.S. government was capturing personal communications. So there were matters of substance here and matters of policy that people objected to a degree to which they didn't with the WikiLeaks cables.
We're talking with author and former diplomat Alec Ross. And so let's get to the author part. You're working on a book about globalization, which is, you know, that kind of small topic. You know, you should be able to bang that out in 5 or 10 pages.
Right.
What are you going to tackle, if you can give us a little preview?
Sure. So when I think about what Thomas Friedman wrote, The World is Flat, he wrote a book that, to the extent that he could, described globalization from 1995 to 2010. Oh, you mean you can go to bed at night and somebody in India is working on your project, and you can wake up in the morning and see what happened. And it was largely rooted in digitization and more open markets. What I don't believe has been written is a book that describes globalization from the years 2010 to 2025 and post-internet innovations, which will fundamentally change the way that we work and live in areas like the commercialization of genomics, cryptocurrencies, big data, and things like this. And so this book is really focused on those changes that are going to take place within technology and science that I think are going to have huge impacts on the global economy and on our lives. And so the manuscript's due in 40-some days, so I'm hustling to get it done.
Oh, my goodness. I know that feeling. So let's dig in on some of these topics. I'm personally obsessed with genomics, and I think it's interesting that you mentioned that in the array of things that are on the table in your book. What specifically are you looking at in that sector?
I'm looking at the commercialization of genomics. So if you think about the process of mapping the human genome, you know, that took a little more than a decade. You know, it ended for the most part some years ago. But the process of turning this into commercial products and services that everyday Americans can purchase to learn more about themselves, their health, their ancestry, their future, that's right around the corner. And billions of dollars of risk capital are now flowing into genomics, the purpose of which is to allow the world's greatest researchers to imagine and invent the future. And so what's interesting for me is I think about genomics like I think about the internet in 1994. It's sort of chapter one, page one. And there's so much that's going to come, and I think going to come relatively quickly, because I do see more and more of the research that historically has been in university labs getting ready for commercialization. And it's going to have an enormously disruptive impact on our lives for both good and bad.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think about, my mother worked when I was a child as a medical technologist, and I was a pre-med for a while, though I gave that up, and my sister's a doctor, and my cousin's a doctor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I just love following the evolution of medicine, and I think that never at any time in human history has there been the ability for certain people with certain resources, not necessarily always financial, but resources like living in a country like the United States, or, you know, having access to a family member or friend who can give good medical advice. Certain people with certain access can do extraordinary things to improve and prolong their lives, whereas other people, even in developed countries like the United States, are living under conditions that will cause early and premature death. And one of the things I think about genomics is that gulf is bound to widen, that you will have people who can go to extraordinary lengths to prolong and preserve their lives, and many other people who will continue to be affected by everyday diseases and things like environmental toxins. So one of the great threads of our time is inequality. And I don't think that we have completely figured out what that means to the evolution of American society and global societies. But do you see the potential for inequality in the era of genomics?
I think that genomics is actually going to contribute to inequality, because I think that the commercialization of genomics is going to overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy and the exceedingly well-connected. And simultaneous to the wealth creation that's going to come from the commercialization of genomics and the wealth creation that benefits not a huge number of people, simultaneous to this, the health of not just low-income Americans, but working-class Americans is actually quite likely to get worse. If you actually look at the data regarding life expectancies for low-income and working-class Americans, it has actually gotten lower in the last decade plus. I mean, since when do we live in a country where people die younger than they did previously as our science grows ever stronger? And so what I believe is that genomics is, over a period of decades, going to benefit more and more people. But for the first decade, it's going to overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy and the well-connected, because the way in which such things are financed, the way in which such things are paid for, is going to be, you know, out of people's checking accounts and not out of any sort of publicly financed or publicly subsidized system that allows a lot of people to take advantage of the content that comes from genomics.
As you're talking about genomics and medicine, there have been some people who have really, you know, denied how influential federal funding has been in scientific development, and others like Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, of course, public intellectual and scientist, who have argued that the foundations of what we end up with in terms of scientific innovation come from federal funding. So what sense do you make of that?
So first of all, anybody who says that public financing for science doesn't matter has absolutely no idea what they're talking about. Just about every pharmaceutical on the shelf of your drugstore, just about every surgical intervention that takes place in hospitals today is rooted to some degree in basic research that at some point was funded by the National Institutes of Health or through some other government-funded mechanism. So basically, the entire basis for modern medicine is rooted in federal funding. And what that means is that, you know, plumbers, teachers, dentists, everybody else have provided the tax dollars that have subsidized that. And so it's a very reasonable point to make to say, hey, if billions of dollars of everyday Americans' money is going to go into the basic research, then ought not it be the case that all 312 million Americans benefit from the results? And I do tackle this. The problem is cohering a market-based economy with a system of public finance. It can be done, but what you can't do is take a completely libertarian, laissez-faire approach to how commercialization takes place. You know, my attitude is that when public dollars do go into basic research that create a pharmaceutical or that create some sort of breakthrough, there ought to be some mechanisms so that people other than rich Americans can benefit from it.
You're listening to One with Farai, part of SoundWorks from PRI. And I'm speaking with author and former U.S. diplomat Alec Ross, who's logged nearly a million air miles for work as senior advisor for innovation to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Now, let me turn back to what people think of more traditionally as globalization issues. So what do you see ahead for jobs in America?
Well, I would say, first of all, that it's never been more difficult to be working class or middle class in America since going back to the 1930s. I say that not as a polemic, but just as a matter of statistical fact. The degree to which there is not just stagnation, but the steady erosion of well-being, purchasing power, quality of life for everyday working Americans is real, and it's rooted in fact. globalization cuts both ways. On the one hand, it creates opportunities for very quick upward economic mobility for people who have the skills to compete and succeed in an increasingly knowledge-based economy. But it really hurts those who lack those skills. You know, the ability to get a job based on the strength of your shoulders, with which you can feed your family and for which you have health insurance. Those good old union wage jobs are largely gone, and I really don't see them coming back for the most part. Even advanced manufacturing jobs, and advanced manufacturing is certainly back on the rise here in the United States, those require a set of skills that you're not going to get with a vocational education degree from high school. So I think that in a global economy made up of 7.2 billion people from 196 countries, being American does not advantage you in the way it did in decades past because of the nature in which competition for labor, competition over human capital, is now global. You know, people in Baltimore are not competing against people in Pittsburgh and Cleveland for jobs. People in Baltimore are competing against people in Bangalore. And so what this means is that education needs to become lifelong. It's not something you just do in high school or college. It also means that people have to be comfortable with increasing mobility in their work lives. And the sum of it is that life is only going to get more difficult for working class and middle class Americans as our economy grows increasingly interconnected and increasingly global.
What, if anything, can the U.S. government or U.S. industry do about that? I mean, I realize those are two very different sectors, but I have been both obsessed with and sometimes very frustrated by the conversation over income inequality because there are very few prescriptive suggestions that I hear that actually make sense to me. So what, if anything, makes sense to you in terms of improving the lives of working class and middle class Americans?
Well, let me try to give one concrete example, one for government and one for industry. For government, billions of dollars flow into vocational education programs today. Those dollar amounts should go up, and the nature of the programs should be fundamentally redesigned. So vocational education is more important today than it's ever been in the past. Look, not everybody has an IQ of 140. Not everybody can get a microbiology degree from Johns Hopkins. That's simply not the way in which humanity is. So what we have to do is we need to make sure that everybody has a chance to get a good job. And one of the ways that we can do that is by making significant investments in vocational education and community colleges, but do so not using yesterday's models, but really doing the sort of almost Singapore-like focus on identifying what tomorrow's skills are and funding the kinds of programs to help ensure that kids coming out of working-class communities have those skills. Now, in terms of industry, where I think labor has really been at a significant disadvantage has in part to do with the degree to which big companies right now are not incentivized to bring their capital to the United States, and in so doing, are not incentivized to hire domestically. What I mean by that is that foreign profits right now are simply not being booked domestically, and therefore taxes aren't being paid on them. So right now, more than $1 trillion are abroad right now. As, you know, America's biggest companies basically are in tax avoidance schemes. So if we can figure out a way to repatriate those dollars and tie the repatriation of those dollars to domestic hiring, I think that that will do more to structurally impact unemployment than just about anything else.
Hmm. So I want to turn to something. I heard you give a speech at New York University, where I teach, and you really spoke quite passionately about the ways in which gender affects global economic growth as well as societal growth. And you made a very persuasive case that it was about dollars and cents as well as common sense and fairness. And it seems to me that both you and your former boss, Secretary Clinton, were very involved in weaving a thread of gender equality through the global geopolitical conversation. So just tell us briefly how you view this.
So my view is that the best case for empowering women at all segments of the economy has less to do with fairness, though we ought to do it as a matter of fairness, but it has to do more than anything else as a matter of arithmetic. there is no stimulus program, there is no austerity program that can produce the kind of economic growth that empowering women at all segments of the economy can. You know, one study done by Goldman Sachs of APEC nations, Asian Pacific nations, indicated that if barriers to full participation by women in the economy were reduced, then the increased household GDP would go up 14% in Asia by 2020. The same study applied to the Eurozone indicated a 9% increase in household earnings. There's no stimulus program, there is no austerity program that can impact our economy quite like that. You know, I traveled 950,000 miles to 41 countries in my 4 years at the State Department.
Can I borrow some frequent flyer miles?
Yeah, you know, one or two.
I'm just kidding.
And I'll tell you what, Farai, I came out of that experience with a conviction. You know, look, I was always in favor, just sort of as a matter of policy. Oh, yeah, sure, women should have equal rights. But I came out of that experience of, you know, having been all over the world saying, you know what, the single best thing we can do as an economic matter and as a security matter is reduce the level of systematic discrimination against women in the economy and in the security sector. There's nothing else we can do. There's no other silver bullet that's out there that can produce the kind of economic and security outcomes that elevating the standing of women can do.
I want to wrap up by asking you about two powerful women, your former boss and your wife. I'll start with your former boss, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. What did you learn about her as a person from working with her?
You know, one thing I learned from her that it just doesn't seem to break through on TV or for whatever reason, I actually think she's very maternal. She treats her staff and treats her others very much like a loving mother. And, you know, just on a personal note, that's one of the things that I took away from her that I just don't think most of the world sees. On a professional note, she is subject to more disgusting commentary than anybody else on planet Earth. And for her to have to live through these things day in, day out is remarkable. But the thing that I took away from her was one time, you know, I was in trouble for something. I was getting some bad press for some crazy program of mine. And she looked at me and she said, Alec, if you aren't taking incoming fire, you're bombing the wrong targets. And so what impressed me about her is knowing that she's made out of flesh and blood, knowing that she emotes and feels things like any other human being does. She's so strong when it comes to taking criticism. And so, you know, a lesson that I've taken from her is to not overcorrect for criticism or hatred from others.
Let me ask you about your wife, Felicity, who has been an award-winning teacher, and you are the parents of three children. And I'm always fascinated by people who take on jobs like you did that keep them away from their family quite often for nearly a million air miles, for one. Just tell me about what you admire about her and what kind of partnership you had to create, especially during the times that you were traveling so often.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't have done anything that I did without Felicity playing the role that she did. You know, it's funny, the first time I actually went to the State Department wasn't because of any diplomatic doings of mine. It was, you know, for her to go and get a Teacher of the Year award. You know, she was a much more impressive professional than I was when we were both in our 20s. Then, you know, when we were in our 30s, you know, Felicity made the choice that a lot of women make, which was, you know, after having kids, to put the kids first. And as my career ascended and as I, you know, went into the high office of politics and government, you know, she really put her own career in last place as she put family first. You know, a lot of people talk about relationships in terms of balance. You know, the very sad, simple fact of the matter is that most relationships like ours actually doesn't exist in balance. You know, it requires extreme selfishness on one person's part and extreme sacrifice on another. And, you know, the choice that she and I made together was, given the opportunity to, you know, work at the elbow of Hillary Clinton for 4 years, for me to sacrifice a lot in terms of being able to contribute at home and being as present for my three little kids as I could have been, And it meant significant sacrifice on her part, where we didn't even pretend like there was any sort of balance at home in terms of who was doing what. And so, you know, she gave up a lot. And, you know, it's hard, but boy, I sure am appreciative of what she did. I'd like to think that the world is a little bit better place for it. And, you know, one of the things that I so appreciate from Hillary Clinton is she always recognized what the other half did. And she always made an extra effort to reach out to spouses and buck them up when they needed bucking up. I always appreciated that in her.
How do you think that women can be better respected by society for whatever choice that women make, whether it is to be a full-time career woman, to split between career and family? What will it take for us as a society to truly embrace whatever options women end up choosing?
There's sort of no kumbaya answer to this, because the way things exist today are really not very good. You know, you can either be the kind of woman who, you know, climbs up the ladder as quickly as possible, and that means not having kids or waiting till you're near 40 or 40 to have kids. And, you know, I have so many friends who are living with the consequence of that and are, you know, almost broken emotionally by it. And then, you know, the other option is to do what my wife did, which is, you know, when she was 29, we decided to start having kids. And, you know, it threw her completely off the ladder. There is no ladder for her at this point. What I really think we need to do is completely change our norms. And I think that there are examples of other countries doing this well. I think that if you look at, you know, Scandinavian countries, for example, if you look at a lot of Northern European countries, they have harmonized motherhood and professional success to a degree to which we haven't in the United States. And, you know, the ferocious debate that took place between Anne-Marie Slaughter and Sheryl Sandberg, sort of taking two different, though I would argue not incompatible, views on women's role at both home and in workplace, demonstrates how keenly felt this is by women and, frankly, by their husbands throughout the country. And the big conclusion I've drawn to is that we're out of balance in the United States. And, you know, we need to change a lot of our corporate policies around things like maternal leave. We need to make our workplaces more female friendly, and we also need to change some of our societal norms.
So we're going to wrap up by doing something called Exquisite, which is where someone, a previous guest, gets to ask you a question. And here it goes.
If you could do one thing to change or address the educational system in this country, what would it be?
Wow. You know, I think the one thing that would have the biggest and longest term impact is to change the standing of what it means to be a public school teacher. Public school teachers ought to have triple the salary that they have today. Today, to be a public school teacher is to be viewed, I think, almost in sort of as a part of the lower middle part of the workforce. There are other countries where teaching 11-year-olds is revered and is elevated in society. And I think that if we were to have a significant impact on education in this country, the single most important thing we could do is elevate the standing of public school teachers and compensate them as such and make it a much more attractive career for high potential people coming out of college.
Fantastic. Now you get to return the favor. You get to throw a question forward in time to someone who you don't know.
Name one thing that is within the realm of the politically feasible that could be done to reduce economic inequality in the United States.
Wow, you returned as good as you got. That's going to be a tough one. And your question came from actor Delroy Lindo.
How cool that I got to answer a question from Delroy Lindo.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the way we roll. So, again, Alec Ross is an author working on a book about globalization and its contents and discontents, and a former diplomat with the U.S. State Department. Thanks so much for joining us, Alec.
Thanks for having me, Farai.
You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. Catch our next installment when I speak with Bird Runningwater of the Sundance Institute about innovations in Native and Indigenous film.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.